Good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
We understand that all of our Virginia members are in Richmond today, and we have some other missing members, but we are going to go ahead with our agenda. The issues that, or the action items that are on the agenda, we'll just simply review them, and if the committee members present agree, we'll just recommend them to the board. So let's get started with our, well, we have, that's right, we can't approve the minutes either. Okay, we'll just get started with our first information item. And on the follow-up questions, I'm not sure that we want to have a discussion of that. What I would ask the members to do is just to review it, to see if they're satisfied with the responses, and if not, just to let us know. And so we'll move to the monthly financial report. Rick.
Good morning. This is the December monthly financial report, so we're halfway through the fiscal year. Looking at the summary on page A1 of the report, most of the trends that we've seen this year and even through last year are continuing this month. Halfway through the year, we've got a revenue favorable amount of almost $16 million. That's about 6% better than budget, primarily driven by rail ridership, rail passenger revenue, which accounts for $10 million of that $16 million. Bus passenger revenue is about $2 million better than budget, and the other $4 million is scattered around the miscellaneous revenue accounts. Expenses are $10 million over budget halfway through the year. The single biggest driver of that is diesel fuel and energy costs. That accounts for about $7 million of that $10 million. Now, the remainder is primarily in personnel, labor and fringes, which is about 1.5% higher than budget, and about $2 million of favorability in some of the miscellaneous categories. So expenses are over budget by 2%. At the subsidy line, we've got $5.6 million of favorability halfway through the year. That's a 3% positive variance. In the ridership statistics, we've seen continuing fantastic rail growth. AM and PM up 3% and 6% respectively. Evening rail ridership up 13%, largely attributed to special events, MCI events, hockey season, those kind of things. Bus was basically the same as last year, but we're seeing about a 2% growth on a year-to-date basis. The ADA statistics that you see here are typos. The correct numbers are actually in the back on page C1. There's about 11% growth in ADA. That 33% is just a typo on that page. The 11% is real consistent to what we've been seeing. It was about 11 or 12% last year, and so don't be alarmed by those numbers. They're just incorrect. And that's the summary for the month.
Do you have any questions on the financial report? All right, then. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the next item, which is the proposed scope of consulting services for business plan development and performance-based budgeting. Now, we had asked for this scope, and I don't know if, well, let's see if members have any questions about the scope. And Chuck, you may want to just take a few minutes and review what we have here.
Okay, thank you. Rick Carcom worked closely with Edward Thomas and his staff, Joel Washington and folks, to put this together. This clearly will be a joint effort, for example, updating the strategic plan. The lead would be Edward Thomas and his organization. And we put this together to show the task, what would be done outside by consulting services, what we would anticipate being done inside by staff, and have given you, I hope, a pretty thorough explanation of what each task would be. We estimate the cost, the consulting cost, to be in the neighborhood of $200,000 to $250,000, but that's an estimate depending on how deeply we get them involved in the whole process. And I'd be glad to walk you through each page, actually have Rick do it as he put it together, if you want to go through each task.
No, I don't think so. I must confess I have not had time to look at the details myself, and I am interested. But I will do that, and if I have comments, I'll get back to you.
Okay, we have widely communicated this inside WMATA through the executive staff. It's been presented to the JCC. We've gotten their input a couple of different times. So we're still kind of in the gathering phase. To the extent anybody has comments, suggestions, input, now's a great time to hear it.
Okay, fine. And I would ask other committee members, if you do have input on this, to by all means let staff know. I must say that I know our estimate for this work is just an estimate, but it does sound like it's something in the range of what we were thinking about, using a combination of in-house staff and outside consultants.
Now that we have the tasks delineated, we have to turn that into billable hours with an estimate of the cost per hour and do that. The next step here would be to come back to this committee with an action item. P&T Consulting Services action item, I would anticipate in March.
Fine.
That we could get started.
Okay. Thank you very much. And now we will continue with our department reviews, and the next review is finance.
Thank you. I'd like to start on the page where you see all the pictures and introduce the staff. The mission of the Division of Finance is to maintain the fiscal integrity of WMATA. There are seven folks in my office, four of which oversee the insurance program, the executive officer, Millie Allen, and my executive secretary and myself. In the accounting office, we have Kathy Smith as the comptroller. Kathy has a staff of 70 people. We have Yvette Downs, who's the acting director of the capital budgeting. Yvette has 15 folks in that section. Rick Harcum, acting director of the budget shop, 21 positions there, and Al Doring, our treasurer, and he has 135 positions.
I have to just take a time out. I look at my own picture and I realize I'm just such a budget geek. I decided to use my son's office picture because he has a much cooler office than I do. Go ahead and show him. He works in the penthouse of that thing. Go ahead and click. He's got a really good view from up there. And go ahead and when we get to the CIP, if you look in miscellaneous work equipment, I've requested one of those.
Where's Miss Adley?
I'm going to use it for budget process re-engineering next year. I'm going to park it on the lawn across the street, and anybody that wants a budget increase comes to see me.
Congratulations on your son.
Thank you,
Mr.
Let's refer that to Al's attempt to wear a lampshade.
And that was one of our better pictures of Al. Okay, on page three, the financial summary that we are presenting, because we're a relatively small division, is that of the entire operation. The detail by office is found in the appendix of this presentation. You see the major increases in the services line, $1.9 million. Those are fees associated with the debit and credit cards that our customers are using. So that's basically just a cost of doing business where we, as the merchant, pay a fee for the use of those cards. The other category, you see $8 million there. The primary expense is for our insurance, our liability insurance. Some $7 million is the premium for that. No increase in the position count, 248 positions. On page four, some of the basic things that are done in most finance departments. We do have operating and capital budgets that we're responsible for. Grants management is an area that I want to strengthen and be a little bit more proactive in managing those grants, making sure they're timely, moving, and closed out. The FTA has mentioned that to us, and we're going to work on that. And of course, Al and his group safeguard our cash, securities, and investments. On page five, our big function next year, of course, will be the performance-based budgeting, and that's the first item listed, developing the business plan and the performance-based budgeting. And we've talked about a number of these things several times before, improving our communications, making the budget documents a little more reader-friendly, user-friendly. You've seen these, we've got these available now, both the executive summary and the brochure that we've made wide distribution on and shared with the JCC folks, and I believe they were glad to receive those. It'll help them communicate the information back in their jurisdictions. On the bottom of that page, these are projects that we're going to focus on next year. The first two, actually, privatization or outsourcing and increased competition. That was part of your resolution, and you had asked us to look at the non-core business functions for the possibility of outsourcing some of those, and that's mentioned in the business plan that we just discussed using a consultant. Task 4.2 mentions going into those. And as we flesh this out, I would anticipate that will be a multi-year project as we pick these different items and look at those, and we're now collecting. There's actually a publication dedicated to outsourcing, so we're trying to find best practices in other authorities as well as government, private sector. What has worked in the outsourcing world? So we're just beginning that, and we'll come back to you as we march through that. The third item, performance engineering, that's actually an energy conservation program where there are ESCOs, energy service companies, and they will come in, they'll evaluate, or in their terms, audit your facilities. They'll look at lighting, heating, cooling, chillers, and the goal is that you install equipment that's more energy efficient, you borrow money to buy the equipment, you amortize the money over whatever you want, but probably something in the 10 to 12 year range. And so you're conserving energy, and then at the end of the amortization period, of course, there are true savings that would accrue. I did this in Fairfax County Public Schools. They're saving about $3 million annually in energy costs. They're into it for about $26 million in improvements. And in Stafford County, much smaller, they're saving about $1 million in energy costs. But that money is reprogrammed to pay the debt service so you can buy the newer equipment. But it's a very popular program. You have better facilities, the lighting is better, and you're saving energy costs, which is one of the drivers of our budget that's going up rapidly. The next item, surplus inventory. This is eBay for public surplus property, it's called public surplus. There's no cost to the user. So when we went to this in Stafford, we just liquidated all the old buses and vehicles that had been sitting on a storage lot waiting for auction. Revenues went up about 30%. There's no fee to the seller. The auctioneer had been charging us 20% in Stafford. That went away. And of course, things move quickly because you take a digital, you put a description on the website, and things move much more quickly. You have less warehousing, if you will, of surplus property. So I'm working closely with Bill Scott on that project. I think we can get that up and running soon.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Dean.
If I could pursue this just a little bit, does that mean the contract that we were led to auction off this equipment is not going out now?
Can't answer that. Is Bill? I'd have to check, Mr. Deegan, and see.
I think this is a great idea, but I was under the impression that the contract was going out this month.
Well, what I did ask in that contract that we make sure there was a clause that would allow us, not lock us into just using that service, that it would allow us to do either or. But I need to take that as a question and respond to you.
Okay.
Hopefully that's the way it went. The last item, if there are no other questions, on this list, efficiency studies. There are a number of companies that will come in. They'll look at your utility bills, your phone bills, your health care payments, make sure you've been charged correctly, the right rates. Do you have phone lines that you're paying for that aren't being used, those type of things. And there's no direct cost to us. There would be a shared, in the savings that they identify would be shared with these firms that come in. So we're in the process of identifying firms, talking with them to try to get some of these things up and running. So these are some of the things we're looking at. I think the performance engineering and the surplus should be very useful to the authorities. So I'm excited about those, and we hope to move those forward relatively quickly.
Now, on these efficiency studies, would they audit our record to then see where their areas were?
Yes, ma'am. That's exactly what they would do. Okay. Our biggest workload is consolidating the records, getting them together, getting them set up for the review, and then they come in and do the work and check the rates and the structure and the schedule and kind of do all the legwork, if you will, and then they'll make a recommendation and tell us what they would propose.
All right, this is something that we've been very interested in. And Charlie, we had a go around on this last budget session, so we look forward to the results on that.
Okay, good. On page 6, These are samples that we've pulled together of things that may be performance measures, and we may change some of these, but Mr. Kaufman may recognize some of these. But these are something we've been on the web, we've looked at what other jurisdictions are doing, and just as an example, you can see on the bottom of the page, there would be a goal of projecting our revenues within a certain tolerance, a certain number of percentage points, and we will refine these numbers, but probably we should be within the 2 to 3% on our projections from our approved budget to our year-end budget. So these are the types of things that I would see us tracking in the budget shop. On page 7, other data that the board may be interested in, cost recovery ratios. These are actual numbers of cost recovery by rail, bus, access for the actual, the current year, and for the coming budget year. Ridership data would be other information that we might want to keep before the public in our budget document.
On the Metro Access, how do we explain the up, down, down, up, down?
The 06 budget was just set too high.
Okay.
This is just a corrective measure. The 06 budget's just pegged a little too high.
Okay. On page 8, going to the Office of Accounting, again, these may change, but you see some of the data that we're tracking. The first one, processing vendor payments. Kathy told me when she arrived here some time ago that more than 30% of the payments were taking longer than 31 days. It's down to 15%. And what we need are benchmarks. We need to know where we are with our competition to see if that's something we should target for improvement or not. So we'll be looking at that. A couple of interesting facts for the last 18 years. The Office of Accounting has received the Government Finance Officer's Certificate of Achievement. And on a non-business side, they also have a charity auction every year around Christmas, the holiday season, which I attended this year. It's very exciting. And in the last 12 years, they've raised over $60,000 for charities, which is pretty cool. On the Treasurer's Office on page 9, again, looking at some of these data, these are the things we'll begin to trend. We have to turn some of these into workload indicators, and we'll see some of those on the next page. Here's an interesting fun fact. We collect 200 million coins a year. Those coins weigh 2 million pounds, roughly equivalent to the weight of 65 buses. There's a little party talk.
Fun fact.
Fun facts. On page 10, still in the Treasurer's Office, some additional indications of performance measures. On number 2, you see credit card fraud loss held to less than 10 basis points, meaning 0.1%. The industry standard that Al has found is that industry-wide, through credit card use, 0.4% is the normal loss from fraudulent use of credit cards. Now, given the volume of business that we do, 0.4% is $400,000, nearly. And we're limiting it to less than 0.1%. So the job that they're doing in Treasury is saving us $300,000 annually from the industry benchmark. And to me, that sums up the reason to have performance-based budgeting. Because if I just said to you, we're losing $80,000, you might say, well, that's terrible. But then if I tell you the benchmark industry-wide is for our volume is $400,000, we're doing a pretty darn good job. And that's where we need to go with performance budgeting. On page 11, again, in the budget office, obviously the business plan and the performance-based budgeting will be their primary task next year. We will work and improve the budget document, get that more informative. Right now, it's, as you know, kind of a series of charts, and it's a little bit hard to take aboard. On page 12 in the capital budget office, we will strengthen the grants program that I mentioned earlier. We will come to you twice a year with an update on the budget. And of course, we will, in the operating side, come to you quarterly. We'll come to you in March with our first quarterly budget update for the operating budget. We're going to do budget manuals for both capital and operating for next year and really strengthen the oversight in the capital area. Those are the main things that we want to do. And then on page 13, if you would like, I could go through office by office the finances, but I'll see your pleasure on that.
I don't think so. We'll just review this unless someone has some interest in it. Oh, Charlie.
Chuck, could you explain? I continue to hear complaints from vendors that they're not being paid on time. And the same way on the payroll, you know, when somebody leaves this authority, it can take up to 90 days to get their final check. And every time I get a response on this, they blame it on PeopleSoft. And I noticed in here that we're going to continue with implementing PeopleSoft.
We are going to, and PeopleSoft is up and running, and we have had some glitches. We have had some vendor payments that had to be given special handling. And we have a team now that's meeting daily of all the key participants in paying vendors. And Rod Burfield is leading that team, but we're aware of it. We've put the team together. Individual cases, Jack Griqua sent me an email yesterday. Anything that comes to the surface, I've asked be sent to me, and we'll handle them individually. I think we're over the biggest hurdle in that. We did have some that got backed up for sure. But if you hear of any of those, if you want to let me know, we'll treat them individually. But I think this team that's meeting daily now, that we will get caught up.
I don't have a problem when they call me and I send it on, they get taken care of. But it just seems to be a reoccurring problem. And I'm worried about this authority losing their discounts on payments.
Well, and I think we've got it under control, Mr. Deegan, in that this team, and we heard the same thing. We're getting things where vendors are calling in, payments are late. And that was the very reason to put the team together. So I guess my assurance would be there are a lot that you're not hearing about that we're handling, and we're getting the payments out the gate, and it's improving every day. But yeah, the system did cause a few hiccups in paying
it's
certain vendors.
It's a reputation we don't want to have for late payment.
We're sensitive to it and working on it.
Hello, question.
Ms. Hunton.
How long has it been since we migrated the PeopleSoft? Wasn't that something recently?
Oh, very, very recent. How many?
It's actually an ongoing process. There's various parts of it that are mm-hmm. coming up individually, but the general ledger system has been live for about a year and a half now.
Have we completed the full migration, or we're still in
the process? No, we're still in the process of migrating. There's still pieces that are scheduled to come online.
Okay, if there are no further questions of Chuck, then before we move to the next department, we do have a quorum, and I'd like to go back to the minutes. I would ask for a motion to approve the minutes.
Post-set.
Yep. January 12th and 16th.
So moved.
Second. Motion and a second to approve the minutes of January 12th and 26th. Any deletions, changes, modifications? Hearing none, then the minutes are approved. Thank you. All right, we'll continue. Mr. Salpez?
Good morning, Mr.
How are you today?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine.
First thing, I'd like to introduce the people who I depend to deliver our program. I'm going to start with the person who has the largest department in my division. That's Mr. Edward Thomas. He's our AGO for planning and information technology. Edward. The second in order of largest staff complement is Mr. James Hagen. He's leading our construction department. Right behind him is Mr. Couch. He has the construction department for all the modernization projects that he has. Jim does the new starts, new projects, reimbursable projects for the most time. And Dave does everything, as we call it, between the fence, which is all of the existing system. Right behind them is Dan Hallow, our chief engineer for vehicles, both for bus and rail. Right behind him is George Lee, our chief engineer for facilities. And right behind him is our chief engineer for systems, Mr. Harry Lupia. And then Mr. Malaski, our managing director for real estate. You all know Gary. And then to my left is my director of administration, Joyce Jones, who is responsible for everything which is not engineering and construction. And you are all aware very well. Go to the next page, please. And I forgot the lady who is running my office, Linda Stofander. She had problems. Yes. She was here. Here she is, right there. Thank you. You all are very well aware of what my division is doing. And what I wanted to emphasize to you, we are a single point of accountability department. Everything related to project delivery, from the planning all the way to sunset of the project. That includes both our mobile assets as well as static assets, that is infrastructure and vehicles. And what is our core mission is to follow the Ramata strategic plan, and our core mission is to learn from the yesterday project how to do tomorrow's project better, faster and cheaper. While we always observe the regulatory aspects of and the oversight and code requirements by the jurisdictions which they regulate us. On page four, the division is the outgrowth of the engineering and construction department. You all know this is the department which built the railroad, 106 miles, 86 days. And as you recall, on last year's reorganization, we moved to have a synergy at all levels, as we call it. But right now we have some 564 staff, and any given time we have 100 to 150 projects going at the same time. The project can be a simple study for extending the capacity on the Vienna station or extending the capacity on the Navy Yard station all the way to a project like a major extension, the Largo extension, and of course the monster contracts we have for our rail cars and the buses. What are the goals? The goals, we work on a work plan. Our CEO approves a work plan at the beginning of the year. We submit it from the different offices. And what are the goals of the work plan is zero tolerance for project schedule delays. On the average, when you spend $100 to do a project with us, the 75 cents will go to actual construction contracting. The remainder will go 12 cents to consulting services, and 10 to and 13 cents for the owner's organization. That's our Ramada organization, which we do. Project management, engineering, inspection, and inside there is included the overhead we pay to the rest of the authority. Every project pays 2.7% paid to the rest of the authority. Do we have accountability measures in place? Yes, we do. There is an accountability panel which reviews the performance of the senior managers involved in the project. Their job is to assess that whether or not the senior managers did everything possible to make sure that the project will be successfully implemented. What we do and how we do it. We do projects from a study, as I said before, all the way to close out the contract. That's the grade of the day. We have projects from 1 million in size to 400 million. We employ some of the largest construction companies on the planet, and so the consulting companies. Every major outfit who is involved in this business sits across the table from us. We advise our CEO, we advise you, the board of directors, on different projects, technology, project risk assessments, cost estimates, and of course we come to you and tell you what the staffing requirements are, because as you know, the majority of our projects are all capital funded. We develop and motivate, mentor our own people. We try to do the best we can, because all of you know it's very difficult these days in our business to go and find, say, a traction power engineer. There are not many traction power engineers on this earth to get, but we try within to develop our own expertise as best as we can, train control, traction power, the traditional railroad engineering disciplines. What are our goals? Our goals is to be total open book, as we call it, complete and open relationship with regulatory and oversight agencies. As you know, the majority of our projects are under the FDA project oversight, management oversight. For that, we have FDA continuously on all our projects. Our chief engineers, they certify that each project has been completed based on a well-formulated quality and safety plan as well, and fully satisfies the FDA three project management principles. Every project, no increase its cost more than 5%, to continuously enhance safety and security, and increase ridership by at least 1%. And we do maintain an open and effective communication with the planning, engineering, and construction staff in our major jurisdictions. Some of you know that I personally chair bi-monthly or quarterly meetings with the jurisdictions, except the District of Columbia, which we used to do it monthly. And that is how we foster the relationship, because I have to tell you, the reason we are still in business is because a lot of reimbursable projects come from our own jurisdictions. They've given us a lot of work to do. That includes parking garages in Montgomery County. You all know the work from Prince George's County. Now Fairfax is coming with more than one project. In Allerton County, we have about 11 projects to complete for Allerton County. But that keeps our staff employed, keeps our staff up to snuff, as I call it, and we are very, very sensitive to the relationship with our jurisdictions. The next page, there's nothing here for me to point to you. It's, yes. Nothing for me here to point to you. Significant is the same thing you saw last year. I don't know the 2%, $1.8 million increase. I guess has to do with the different salary adjustments and so on, which I can read and talk to you about it. The only thing I would like to bring your attention here is on page 6. If you see the bullet says advancement of the Dallas Metro Rail project. If this project doesn't happen, 50 of the people who saved their jobs, some of you remember 2 years ago, they have to go. Because the majority of my people, as you know, they are not part of the operating budget, they are all part of the capital budget. And they are here.
At least three politicians are going too.
Thank you. But nothing new here. Now I would like to start with a couple minutes for each of my direct reports. And I would like Edward to tell you a little bit of what he's doing and what are his benchmarks.
Okay, good morning, everybody. I'll just quickly go through the planning program and the information technology program. Most of these activities you're pretty much familiar with. But we do try to foster as much integration among the various modes that we operate as possible. On the planning side, as you know, we're fostering the development of improved access at many of our stations. We're going through the inventory process, and we'll be coming forward later in the year, this fiscal year, to bring forward some improvements, and we'll continue to do work in that area in FY07. We have a number of corridor studies on the way. In fact, we're wrapping up some corridor studies in the District of Columbia and as well in Northern Virginia. There'll be other studies coming along next fiscal year as well. We're continuing to work with operations and other departments in the authority to advance the high-priority bus corridors. We have three corridors that we'll be rolling out in May to the board, and we'll be working on others in FY07 as well. The one thing that is enlisted here that Chuck talked about was updating the strategic plan and the capital plan as part of the business plan update and as well the re-engineering of the budget process. On the information technology side, we're going to be wrapping up the implementation of the new business systems. Many of those systems are up and running. Now, as you know, the PeopleSoft will be moving aggressively into getting the inventory management system to the Maximo software, get that work implemented this fiscal year and as well getting it finalized in 07. We have actually started restructuring our IT program. We're transitioning the people who have been working on the new systems deployment effort. We're moving them into the ongoing IT day-to-day operational activities, and that effort is really one of our emphasis areas for the balance of this fiscal year, moving into 07 as well. We've identified a few measures here. We'll be continuing to work on them, but one of the things we do intend to do is 100% implementation of the ITRP program. We appreciate the board providing some additional resources to get that job done. We do provide the support for the rail operating computer system, the so-called ROCs. We have a 99.9% reliability factor that we keep in front of us all the time. We'll be working with all the jurisdictions in terms of the planning program support and as well working with the regional transportation planning board to make sure that our capital needs are reflected in the long-range plan and as well in the six-year transportation improvement programs that go to the federal government for review. So that's an overview of the planning and information technology areas.
Mr. Smith.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. In the packet, on the detail on the ITRP, I just was flipping through and noticed you might want to correct that or at least explain that. It appears we've got 19 volunteers working in that
They are actually not volunteers. This program was supported through staff from various other departments throughout the authority. There are 18, actually, people that were assigned to work full-time on the ITRP. They're funded out of the capital budget for that particular program. Once the program is completed, we'll have to decide whether to return those individuals back to their departments or maintain some of those individuals in the IT program, and that's part of that transition activity that will start.
Well, in those departments, when they sit here with their packages, do they show up as employees in those departments?
No.
They don't?
No. They're not funded out of the operating budget. They're part of the project, capital budget.
Okay, so we're not double counting 19 somewhere?
No.
No, not at all. So, for example, the budget office had to give one of our people over to this project 100%. So that position, that employee is now in Edward's shop.
Okay, well, interestingly enough, though, what happens then is that employee doesn't show up in the account on your chart, but the money for it does?
No, the money's here, and on the capital expense line item, the $2.4 million.
All in the capital.
Yes, sir. All that labor cost is in that capital, because it's a capital project. I can take that line called capital expense and break it into a labor component, a fringe component, a services component, just like everything else. Just for simplicity, we've only broken out the operating budget portion on the top of these pages.
Can I? So the position from your shop that's contributing to this,
mm-hmm.
is it funded in your shop?
No.
It's not funded. It's just a position?
It's not in my shop anymore. It used to be a budget position, and the cost of that position was budgeted in the budget office.
Right.
It's now been transferred to this new office called ITRP. It's one of the 19 positions that you see here.
Right. So it went from operating funding to capital funding?
Exactly.
Now, I should point out that as we go through this transition, Ms. Mack, we'll have to decide how many of those positions we may want to return back to the operating departments, because they're going to be experts in these new software packages, these packages are really more user-friendly, and we expect that the departments will have some of their own in-house sort of expertise to support these new software packages.
So when they go back to the operating
mm-hmm.
offices, will the funding, do they take that money with them? I mean, how does the money switch from capital?
No, once the project is completed, the capital funds are exhausted.
Right. So conceivably, there could be an operating cost increase. My office expense might go up by the cost of one person, because that person who's been working on the capital project for 3 years now comes back to me as an operating person.
But did you ever have money in the operating budget for that person?
Yes, and it was cut out.
I see.
So when the person is finished with, when the 19 people are finished with the job,
mm-hmm.
and the job is done.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need them anymore.
Yes, we do. These people are resident experts. They have to come back to the offices where they came from. If I were to lose my PeopleSoft expert, my budget system would fail within a couple of months. These people, and it's a best practices. This is one of the things that we studied pretty hard before we got into this.
You mean having the people is the best practice?
Yes.
Yeah, that I understand, okay? And I can understand that. I'm just trying to get over how we're moving the shells around with the money underneath them to define those people here. Because we've got money coming out of capital money
mm-hmm.
that's covering these 19 positions
mm-hmm.
that are doing specific work that is entirely necessary.
Okay.
But then that work is done, but we still need those people, but we don't have that money anymore, and we've got to go take it from an operating account.
Next year, and maybe the 08 budget, when my PeopleSoft expert comes back, you could look at my office and see a cost increase in the operating accounts to pay for that person. So in year zero, that person was budgeted in the operating program. In year one, operating expense went down, capital expense went up. I get to the end of the project and we just reverse it.
Why did we have to sneak the money out of... Why did we have to take the money out of capital money somewhere to fund them in the first place? Why didn't we just go fund them through operating in the first place?
It's just the basic of accounting for people with the work that they're doing. They are fully dedicated to executing a CIP project.
But you're telling me you couldn't get operating money to do it, so we found capital money somehow.
No. It's simply a recognition of having people budgeted and accounted for with the work that they're doing. They are not, the one guy that I'm talking about is not doing budget work right now. He is implementing a capital improvement project to the authority.
Okay, is everyone that we have, Mr. Salpez, everyone we have implementing a capital project, as was just described, funded out of capital money?
Yeah.
Or is there operating money that, but everybody?
Close to 95%, and maybe some projects they require somebody to come out from operations and be a support to them while the project has to be turned on, you know, as part of the operating envelope. But yes, for the most part, yeah.
You have a question?
But then in the other charts here, we have labor and fringe and services costs for various employees that aren't listed as capital.
It varies from office to office.
Yeah.
Some offices are more related to operating, day-to-day operating the bus and the rail company. Some offices are completely dedicated to executing capital projects.
Right. As an illustration, Mr. Smith, if you go back to, there's the page, my slide says 20, but it's the information technology and services. It's in the appendices. You'll see that $14.5 million of our IT program comes out of the operating budget. So within this division, a large portion of the operating labor costs are reflected in the IT group that does the ongoing operations and maintenance of our computer system.
The primary reason we do this is when a capital project finishes, if there's not some follow-on piece of work, the people who are working on that go away. Hawk has just mentioned that. We've got 50 positions.
Which was kind of my question a couple minutes ago. But in this case, they don't go away because we desperately need them.
There's now an ongoing operating need for them.
Okay.
Now,
capital project created an ongoing operating need.
One of the opportunities will be that if we have existing vacancies in these various departments, we might be able to absorb some of that 19 through existing positions and not necessarily the
I have every confidence position. We'll have those.
Yeah.
What out of the 2.4 million shown in capital, how much of that for these 19 people is labor and fringes? How much of it is
probably food? Almost all of it.
All of it. Yes. So we're talking about people on a roughly $130,000 a year, $126,000 a year level.
With fully loaded.
Fully loaded,
high end IT people.
Thanks. Let me ask you a question. Why don't we show in our capital expense the number of positions that are funded within each capital budget?
I can, and actually in the budget books you can see FTEs broken out by operating capital.
I think that would be helpful because seeing the going back and forth, I think would be clearer and answer some of the questions that we've been asking her.
Yeah, and okay. I'm not trying to drag people into the book, but in the staffing tables we keep in the computer systems, we track whether everybody's FTE is an operating FTE or capital FTE, and then there's people like us up here that are overhead, and we're split across all the budgets.
But in this presentation, since we're presenting it that way, it would be appropriate to show the capital.
That's a good idea.
Well.
Okay. May I proceed? Yeah. On page 10.
Speaking as well.
Just one more talk.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'll be back to you.
I'm used to it. You know, it's bad when you get used to being neglected.
That's our history.
You know? That month down the years.
I'll be quick for you, Mr. I noticed in FY06 it's 2.4, and FY07 it's 1.5. But the people stay the same.
There might be some amount of non-personnel cost. I'm going to have to kind of drill down into that number. I can get back to you with the specifics of what that changes.
Might be a lot less than 95% then.
I don't know off the top of my head. We've got the detailed information upstairs. I can get it.
Okay, thanks.
I'm dancing. I just want to make sure that I was respected and you were acknowledging the fact that you told me I could speak next.
That's appropriate, Mr. Lane.
Actually, I think we got the clarification that I was seeking trying to clarify the line of questioning that are being pursued by Mr. Smith in terms of the 19 employees and then going back to operation, because they will then be integrated into the implementation of the software that they have been working on and developing on the capital, and that's why the software is also being built here. Okay. Thank you. All right, Chair.
You're welcome, you, Mr. Lynch. Mr. Salpez.
Yes, Mrs. Mike. The next on page 8 is Gary Malaskis' department, which has to do with the property development and management. We all got to know, I said, the real estate department or the land department. You know pretty much what they're doing right now. On their work program, they have 54 real estate and joint development projects. That's the transactions, if you like, that they have in various stages. Then they are focusing on retail concessioning program at Metro Rail stations. They completed the ATM installation in 35 stations. And Gary is telling me they have generated something like $150 million in support of the authorities' operations. You all know about the stuff on the tip and so on. They have some work to do in the Vienna station with the real estate disposition, and then to coordinate other possible dispositions as the board director and so on. That Gary can tell you that, what are your benchmarks?
Good morning. We do a lot of managing process, and we, certainly in the joint development a program, get the deals done, collect the fees that come in. We also collect fees from fiber optics, from payphones, from the new ATM program, from property sales, so the idea is to contain, to do 100% collection of those things, coordinate the projects, and comply with all the federal and state regulations that we're subject to.
Thank you. Page 9 and 10 and 11, Mrs. Mack, I have the three chief engineering offices, and I can summarize it for you very quickly. Our chief engineers, their role is to provide 24/7 support to operation. They are the top engineers for the authority, and starting with the vehicle engineering, additionally to his everyday duty to support engineering aspects of vehicles, both bus and rail, also has project management capabilities and to bring here the rail cars and the buses we buy. On page 10, the chief engineer for systems, Mr. Lupia, is responsible for all engineering aspects, 24/7, train control, traction power, communication, and ventilation, and all the systems related to our railroad. On page 11, our chief engineer for facilities, George Lee, is responsible for everything which is not moving. I'm on page 12 now, and I told you about the construction projects, which you all know. The construction department under Mr. Higgins is divided in three jurisdictions: District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. In the District of Columbia, Mr. John Thomas is the senior project manager. He's totally dedicated to all the projects related to the District of Columbia. In the state of Maryland, Colin Myers is the person you all know. He was our project manager for the Largo extension, and now he's finishing the new Carlton yard and all the other yard improvements we have in parking garage. And of course in Virginia, our senior project manager is Dan Corazin, who is dedicated to the Dallas project and does the Huntington parking garage and the Vienna garage eventually and so on. All these people report, as I said, to Jim Higgins, you all know. And Jim's measures and benchmark is to continue to update existing construction tools and contracting practices, document lessons learned by project, provide project management performance to total satisfaction of the public agencies. I reminded you that pretty much all our construction program is reimbursable by others, therefore we have to obey and listen to the requirements of the public agencies. Also, all the projects have to be managed by credentialed engineers and construction managers, and my requirement to my staff is in a year after the project is finished, we need to do our best to close out the contract. Some of you know, because of this performance the last few years, we were able to find a little bit of money here and there to close out the contract, and sometimes we come before you and say we found a little bit more money to invest in other areas, and that's very important. On page 13, Mr. Kalachik's up. You all know what Dave is doing. Dave right now has something like 60 projects going on, and his fiscal year 07 and Dave's project can be a small project of $500,000 all the way to something like $150 million, which he does the traction power substations upgrade. He has 30 projects under detailed design, which will be ready to get the construction the next year as soon as you approve the next year's capital budget. Similar and symmetrical goals and objectives, Dave has to continue to continuously update the existing construction tools and contracting practices, document the lessons learned, provide project management performance to total satisfaction of the public agencies, ensure all projects are managed by credentialed engineers, and report before you twice a year. You remember, March and October of every year, we report the performance of the capital program. Next year, on the next month, on the P&D committee, you're going to receive the semi-annual update where all the projects are and so on. And of course, Dave is also obligated to close all contracts 1 year. The Office of Administration, the lady to my left, Ms. Jones, has three major functions. Function one, project controls. The project controls manager works for her, and independently of the project office, they produce the project controls report for every month for oversight agencies, myself, the CEO, you, whomever is asking for that. Also, she has the Assistant Director of Compliance, Mr. Lou Viner, whose key job is to be the authority's independent estimate. All of you know that we are obligated to have independent estimates. Estimates come out of the project manager, that's good, fine, but also we need to have an independent estimate. That's part of our procurement requirements and the federal requirements. For that, he does all the independent estimating, the independent schedule reviews, and under him is Jim Mas, you all got to know him. He's our environmental compliance man who changes the permits or clears projects to go to construction and so on. And then all the projects, they work based on the project manual. That the project managers, the project engineers, they have to be in compliance with our manuals. And that's the safety, like that's the enforcement function of her office and through her assistant director. Then the last thing, care office does is that they do frequent quality and safety audits on the project managers. That is not the quality and safety audits done by the Office of Safety and Risk Management for Mr. Fred Codin. That's within the project, therefore I do have a clear idea what's going on. My directors know what's going on. And then she does the human resources, not the human resources what Bill Scott is doing, the human resources to help the project. As you know, in my department, continuously we have involved doors. We finished the construction project in White Flint. There were five people who were there. Where are they go next? This is the project they're going to go next. That might change from office to office. They might go and work with Dave Couch, who does the rehab of the Addison Road parking garage for 3 or 4 months. And they come back to do the Huntington parking garage and so on. But continuously she has this different between the offices changes, and she has a couple of people working there. Her measures and benchmarks is 100% FDA management plan compliance, because every operation we have is based on the FDA project management plan. She's responsible at all requests to give an independent cost estimate. When people want to enter the contract, some of you remember, you ask me once in a while to check the cost. That's care of is that they depend. And of course, she's in 100% compliance with. I'm done. I was waiting.
I'm fine. Madam Chair.
Mr. Kaufman.
One of the questions I have, and you know, kind of brought this to my attention, is the issue of the availability of restroom facilities. When it comes to code compliance, building code compliance, obviously, I'm sure we meet every code when we build a project. But as codes change over time, do we have someone specifically tasked within your office who ensures that you remain in compliance with all the various codes over time?
Yes. Mr. Kaufman, the three chief engineers, the number one objective or number one job description item, if you like, is to make sure they are up to date on all the codes. Because the guy who does the vehicles, he needs to know what are all, the guy who does facilities, and the guy who does the system. In the case you refer to is related to facilities codes, and George Lee, he's the chief engineer. Right below George is our chief architect, who is responsible for the particular building codes and so on. The answer to your question is yes.
Is it something I just like to speak with those individuals on that side issue? I appreciate it.
Mr. Lynn.
First time.
How about that?
I have a similar question. I know from time to time, and I've experienced this recently, where the jurisdictions are planning major developments along our parcels. And very often they have these major issues regarding capacity. One of the issues that continues to come up is whether or not, by their building these new complexes, whether or not it will surpass or meet challenges on our capacity within our rail systems. What kind of messages are we delivering to them? I've heard some inconsistency in that message. I've been informed that there have been occasions where we've actually told jurisdictions that there is additional capacity, that we can accommodate the growth. Yet, in fact, I thought the message of the authority, particularly along the rail line, was that we had pretty much tapped out capacity. We're looking for 8-car trains. We have issues of capacity with expansion, even where we need to look at our platforms. So I'm trying to find out what is the message we're delivering, and what is that message?
Well, you know, when this comes down to these issues, my colleague is Jim Hughes. He's the man who I depend to give me the inside operating capacity. And Jim always shoulder to shoulder with me if we have a question like this. If you have anything specific, I can tell you how we handle it.
Tell me about the red line capacity within Montgomery County with all of the development projects that are going on. What is the message that we're delivering as the counties and others come to us, parking planning and the like, meet with us and say, you know, we're going to build a new facility and there are going to be 5,000, 10,000 residents that are right on top of your station. So what are we saying to them in terms of our ability to accommodate?
That's a great question.
Well, let me jump in there, Takis. I mean, what we've done is we take the COG regional planning forecast information, which comes from the local jurisdictions, their planning departments. And each time COG does its updated cooperative forecast, we factor that into our systems level review, which then forecasts, based upon the standards that we have, the crowding on the system and on the trains. And you might remember that was the basis of the analysis that was used for our core capacity study. It showed different lines reaching, quote, their maximum capacity at different points in time, based upon those regional forecasts. That information is updated when COG does their update. That formed the basis of the Metro Mavis funding agreement, which supported the purchase of the 192 rail cars, which then showed, and I say this theoretically on paper, a capacity that is finite. And then we show people, based on that, when each line reaches its maximum capacity. And as we all know, Metro Mavis bought us some time, a few years, and then early in the next decade we'll be back in that same place that we were a year or two ago, which is to say that the system is tapped out, doesn't have any additional capacity. It varies by line. Now what we have done as a supplement to that, and Edward can speak to this, is to begin to do the station by station evaluation, because all of our work prior to that was at a systems level, and we were obviously finding out that as the closer you came to hitting your capacity, the more important it was to have that information on a station-specific basis. In these work plans that Edward has been developing, there are identification of the specific stations that we are now creating, station area analyses that are now more microscopic and more surgical based upon those things that you spoke of, Mr. Linton, which is the specific development activities that are approved or are pending with local governments, an effect of what that will be on not only the trains, which we had primarily been focused on, but the stations itself. Because now we now find out that we have access to circulation problems inside of our stations that we weren't really as focused on as we needed to be. And a good example is the one that sort of pushed us out of the box fast was Vienna. Related to all the Vienna development that was going on, we moved up and accelerated in our plans the actual microscopic assessment of the Vienna capacity to evaluate all those issues that were going on with respect to the development proposal that's pending in the county that ranges all the way from, you know, access and parking to vertical circulation, fare gates, stairs, elevators, escalators, and that thing. So I don't, so I guess, I mean, Edward can expand on this notion of the microscopic station specific, but that is the recent improvement that we've brought in.
I appreciate that, Mr. White, and I thank you for that elaboration. Let me be a little more specific. The Shady Grove area in which the Montgomery County Council took some legislative action recently, my understanding through that talking to several people that there was some discussion that suggests that we had opportunity there for additional capacity that would absorb a higher level of development, and that was the message that was communicated, and that several members of council acted on that information. And I was curious because that seemed to be contrary to what I thought our situation was.
Yeah, in the case of, actually, I spoke to Mr. Linton about this particular situation. As mentioned by Mr. White, we do have a clear message on the systems level because it did serve as a basis for the Metro Matters, and in fact, it served as a basis for our 10-year plan in 2006. And we basically have said that with the additional rail cars, we'll be able to get passenger utilization down to about 92% on the average. But we only have about 2 or 3 years of relief. And then we'll re-congest, and the red line would be one of the lines where we would, in fact, experience some additional congestion problems in, say, post-2012 period. Now, the Shady Grove station has been kind of evolving in terms of exactly what the plan is going to be. I know that the county and as well as the planning agencies that represent the state and the county haven't really settled on exactly what's going to happen, unlike Vienna, where there's been kind of a consensus on the part of the jurisdiction in terms of what the development plan is actually going to be. So it's conceivable, we'll have to kind of get into the details a little bit more, that the whoever made a statement about this particular issue, number one, they're wrong, because we are going to see some additional development at that site, and it is going to have an impact not only at that station in terms of parking demand and as well as station-related facilities, escalators, elevators, and maybe even some of the fare gates might need to be increased, but and that will be compounded with some additional capacity downstream. So we know we're going to have capacity problems at that particular station, and we're probably going to have some capacity problems along the line, but we haven't really confirmed, you know, the details and all of that. So we'll check into exactly what was said, because the story is we definitely have system-wide capacity problems. We're going to have some relief, but we're looking at these stations, and we have stations experiencing 100% or more growth in the last 5 years, and they're continuing to grow, and Shady Grove is one of them.
I didn't want to push your button, Mr. Smith, so why don't you just relax?
I
thought you'd be interested in the information, because that's, I had heard something someone told me, and I said, wait a minute, where's all this capacity coming from? It doesn't seem to be consistent to anything I've heard, more than anything I've been seeing.
It's interesting, too, that some of these the statements regarding the growth of the various stations or system-wide, you can make various statements that can, in effect, all in and of themselves be true. But you've got to step back and see the whole forest at some point, because Shady Grove, in and of itself, all the development that might be planned there may well have reasonable capacity that people feel like they could get on the train in a reasonable manner, move off the platform, clear the platform, move the train along. And so in that sense, it would be true that there is capacity at Shady Grove. The unfortunate thing would be then for the people of Rockville and Twin Brook that now have no place to go and are stuck on the platform, and compounded by the development that's going to occur at those locations as well. So you can have individually true statements that might necessarily, when compounded, be a significant problem.
And I want to make sure it's very clear, for all my entire career, I have supported joint development. So this is not, you know, anti-growth issue at all. My biggest fear is that we supported and asked for it, now it's coming.
Right.
So it's a good problem to have, but it is still a problem. And if people don't foresee what the impact is going to be, think about that when they do development, and we're just compounding the problems we already have.
And in fact, we don't, I mean, the reality of it is, until we get that escalator finished at Shady Grove, we don't have capacity at Shady Grove today, because clearing that platform is a nightmare right now. That whole scenario, or that whole full-scale model, as it were, right now, only gives you a glimpse of what the future might be if we don't adapt and reconfigure or add to the capacity of the platforms at those stations.
I won't continue this, Madam Chair, but I just think the work that's being done at the station area stuff is extremely important. And the consistency of the communication of the message as to where we are is extremely important. Because at some point, we, the developers and other people, may have to buy into supporting the necessary capital needs we're going to have in order to accommodate the growth that they're bringing. And we need to be able to talk about that in some concrete way.
This is my conclusion.
Mr.
I just wanted to dovetail, but picking it just a little bit to a broader level, looking at system-wide, the points Mr. Lutz made. Certainly, as Metro Rail enters its 30th year, the issue of capacity and issues of maintenance are going to become all the more clear. A lot of what I think we're dealing with is capacity is often perceptually driven. Folks are used to, you know, on a road construction and management, they're that ADAP scale, where C is, you know, that's great, but in most new developments designed, so it gets the level service needs. Folks have been used to riding our Metro Rail system where there's plenty of room, noise to see, and now it's getting closer to being better used. No one abandons an interstate when they have to slow down, so no one should be abandoning our trail or train system or assuming doom is at hand because it gets a little bit more crowded, because that's what we hope to see happen in this time. The other challenge, though, that I always find amazing is folks not realizing the maintenance. Every time there has to be single tracking on a weekend, it's taken for granted that roads have potholes, curb and gutters, collapses, and there are detours from time to time. But when that happens on a rail system, my God, there goes Metro again. So these are things that we're going to have to be dealing with, perceptual issues as well. And as we look at the communication with our ridership and the use of our rack and other things, this is driving home the point that many of the pains we're experiencing are in fact recognition of the success of the system.
I don't think we have any more questions for you, Mr. Chavez.
Thank you very much.
Okay, our next department is Workforce Development and Administration. Mr. Scott.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
Morning, members of the board. Morning, members of the board. I'd like to begin by introducing my staff and people I work with. We have very good staff, and I'm very proud of working with them. First person I'd like to introduce is Gregory Boykin. He's the Director of Administrative Programs and Services. Gregory came to us out of the Succession Planning Program. He has 20 plus years of service here with the authority. Next person I'd like to introduce is Teresa Bailey. She's the Director of Civil Rights, the Office of Civil Rights. Teresa. Teresa came to us from the University of Maryland. She's been with the authority for approximately 3 years. Next person I'd like to introduce is identified as B. Richard Froehlke. Director of Employee and Labor Relations. Dick and I have worked together a number of years, Dick. Next person is Katrina Wiggins. Katrina's been with us over 5 years. She's the Director of Human Resource Management and Service. Katrina?
She did.
Very good. Next person is Richard Platt. He's the Director of Organizational Development. He's been with us approximately 11 years. And the person to my left is Adrian Hendricks, Acting Director of Compensation and Benefits. Adrian's been with us approximately 11 years. Next person is Lucy Jackson. She's serving in the active capacity of the Managing Director of Procurement and Materiel. She's been with us over 3 years. I want to express to you appreciation. I wanted to also address our mission. Mission is to recruit, develop, and retain a qualified workforce that is reflective of the diverse demographics of the region by supporting the principles of fairness and equality. Provide responsible administrative services and ensure the timely acquisition of goods and services necessary for this operation of Vermont. Next page is relatively boring with respect to our budget. Not much of a variance, only 1%, and no position increases for 07. There is a decrease in services, which I've been talking with Chuck Woodruff about, $300,000 in services. As you know, we're engaged in collective bargaining right now with Local 689 and Local 2. They have to come back to Chuck and pay for some more money on services. However, right now we're at 1% variance and not much change there. Go over the 30,000 foot level as to what we provide the authority, the value we believe we add to the authority here, and that is, first we provide strategic policy advice, workforce and procurement matters, both to the CEO and to you, Board of Directors, for approximately 70 personnel and 8 procurement policy. We conduct collective bargaining, negotiations, and interest arbitration, which we view as very, very important, and I'm sure you do as well, covering approximately 85% of the employees and impacting approximately 70% of the operating budget. Develop, implement, administer over 21 authority-wide compensation and benefit plans, pay, retirement, and health, based on internal and external workforce analysis. We do that in order to maintain a competitive relative marketplace. Provide strategic policies and plans regarding hiring and recruiting, covering approximately 1,000 new hires annually and 240,000 personnel actions while maintaining policy compliance with the FTA and DOT alcohol regulation. That's about 4,800 medical exams and about 10,000 drug, 2,000 alcohol tests each year. We also provide strategic policy advice on and resolution to EEO, affirmative action, workforce diversity, and Title VI issues. This is done to ensure compliance with WMATA policy and applicable federal laws, in order to maintain, and we're proud of this fact, a discrimination-free workplace. Right now, for the record, we have only approximately about 10 active cases out of a workforce of 10,000. We believe that is a milestone, considering the diversity and various issues that you have in this workplace. We have only 10 active cases. I believe that's very significant. A large part of that is due to the actions we've taken on the front end of the process, the alternative dispute resolution program that we recently implemented that this general manager supported. We manage and advise and support Vermont staff in the acquisition of goods and services, the authority's capital operating and reimbursable requirements to ensure the best value in finalizing approximately 14,000 contracting actions. Develop and maintain and manage employee business processes to ensure proper space planning. That's a new requirement that we have now. The timely delivery of mail service. We process over 300,000 pieces of mail. Cost efficiency, efficient wireless communication. We have 1,500 users. And responsive travel to 800 requests. Client asset management of 4,000 property transactions and a comprehensive employee program that covers 2,000 employees in this building. And we program and implement the training, development, and asset assessment, rather, of WMATA employees, managerial and professional skills essential to the improved delivery of services. We have our performance goals and measures. We recognize that this year, in 07, is the beginning of the requirement by the board to identify quantitative performance goals. These are in development, but these are the goals that we have today that we will be continuing to modify as we go through this fiscal year. We want to reduce the vacancy rate 4% and fill
the high spot, Phil.
Pardon?
Just get the high.
Okay. All right, very good. Now, reduce the time. All right, just we want to reduce the vacancy rate. That's very, very important to us. But just recently, Mr. White and I discussed in the fall of this year, looking at our whole health care system, both all union and non-union, and we commissioned a study to be done, and that study is just recently completed with respect to looking at our health care system authority-wide. And we have that report now, and we see where we can make some changes in our health care, and also the fact that we know where we stand with respect to jurisdiction, with respect to the federal government, the like, with respect to our health care plan. So we have a comprehensive report just recently being completed. That's very important, and we'll be advising the board about that in due time. And moving through, I think that the others are just revising the policies to maintaining compliance administratively. And that's about it. In the interest of time, I won't go into any more detail.
Okay. Ms. Smith.
Yes. What are strategic space planning services?
That's the comprehensive report that we just gave to the board within the last month or so, in December, when we identified 54,000 square feet of space that we have here at the authority, and 4 million rather, and what we were planning to move forward on that.
I see. Okay. Thank you,
ma'am. I wanted to feedback on that question. The space plan that you gave us back a couple of months ago, do we have any planning for a regular update on that? Because there
yes, we do. We were going to come to you through the P&D committee, scheduling that update, and in fact it was going to be it was postponed, but we are going to have it in March, I think.
Yes. Good morning, everyone.
Usually appointed, but he's in charge of the space plan.
Okay.
Thank you. We had approximately 9 follow-up questions after that presentation on December the 1st, and part of it had to go through the budget re-engineering process to present to the budget committee, and Mr. Woodruff, and through discussion with him, was going to address the contracting out issue, and then we will go back to the follow-up presentation specifically addressing those 9 follow-up questions to the P&D committee.
Follow-up on your question, we will be providing updates.
Right, okay, because there was a lot of planning in there, and it would be good to be updated on how much of that is actually being implemented and what phases.
Yes,
sure.
Yes,
sir.
Okay. Mr. Graham, you had a question?
Yeah, I did. I guess this is the last of the budget, the procurement and materials, RMP.
Yes.
This is where the DBE program is.
Pardon?
This is where the DBE program is.
Yes, it is.
So can we focus on that for a minute and find out what's happening and what the resources are for the small and local business preference program?
As Ms. Lucy Jackson is acting.
In terms of, good morning.
Good morning.
The small and disadvantaged business program, small and local preference program. We have a staff that's headed by a director for that area, Gwen Harris Gale, and she has a staff of DBE specialists and vendor relations specialists in that shop. I believe it's about 7 DBE specialists and 2 vendor relations specialists working in that area.
Do you have what you need to do this program correctly?
Yes, we're still in the process of recruiting and filling vacancies for that area.
Well, how many vacancies do you have?
We have, I believe, there are 2 vendor relations specialists.
Is there a backlog in terms of the number of businesses that are qualifying and applying for this?
Yes, there is a backlog.
She's responsible as director for that operation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. Yes, there are about 52 outstanding applications for certification at this point.
And how many have been certified?
We have approximately 400 plus certified DBEs.
So we're running a backlog of somewhat over 10%.
Correct.
That being pretty much a standard backlog.
Yes.
That would suggest to me that you... Although if you have two vacancies, do these two vacant FTEs relate to the process?
No, actually, the vendor relations are the ones who actually help all vendors apply to do business with WMATA, not just the DBEs.
Well, why aren't we processing these?
Well, what happened was I've been out sick for the last 2.5 weeks, and I was the one who wanted to go through that because of the importance of estimation. Let me just explain to you with DBEs. There are actually two areas in the DBE group. One is certification, and the other is the contract compliance. And right now, what I'm trying to work on is to improve the compliance side of the house. We have two of our DBEs working on compliance, ensuring that our contractors are meeting all of the rules and guidelines of 49 CFR 26. And we are, I've got three of our DBEs working on the certification. So you actually only have three DBEs at this point doing certification.
Three DBE specialists. Well, are you suggesting to me that I'm glad you're feeling better?
Well, somewhat feeling better. Thank you.
Well enough to be here.
Yes.
I'm glad you're here because, you know, here we have the question.
Okay. Yes.
But are you suggesting to me that this backlog has just occurred recently?
No, that's usually the running backlog. The thing is that it's probably going to increase because I'm now moving into developing the contract compliance side of the house.
Well, Madam Chair, should we be concerned that this program, which is so very relevant to, you know, our small local businesses, is falling this far behind, and maybe we'll... I heard you. Your name again, I'm sorry?
Gwen Harris-Gale.
Ms. Harris-Gale is telling us that now it's likely to fall back further. I mean, do we need to be concerned about this?
Let me step in and say that. Let me step in and say this. I will provide whatever resources she needs to ensure that the program doesn't fall anymore. If I have to allocate additional positions, I will do so. We will maintain or try to reduce the backlog. She and I have not had our dialogue. She's been out as she indicated. But I have allocated more resources to the area, and I will continue to do so until the backlog is reduced. We can be at an acceptable level of...
I'm sorry, Gordon. Did I breathe on your actually,
that was not a strategic move by us at all.
Actually, Mr. Lindner, I have bronchitis. It's bacterial and not viral, so you won't get it.
Well, it's also comforting to know that Mr. Scott, you're concerned about this, but if I'm hearing this correctly, this has been an ongoing backlog of this size, and so, you know, I can't say that I've heard complaints from these folks, but I would suspect, what's the age of these applications? How long have they been pending?
Well, 49 CFR gives us 90 days. And so I would say they're certainly below 90 days because I monitor.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not beyond the 90 days.
No, we're not beyond the 90 days.
What happens in the 90 days if we haven't certified? Do they automatically become certified?
No, because we do have to follow certain rules. Some of them have home state issues, so if they're out of state, they must be certified by their home state. And if we haven't gotten that information by the 90 days, what I inform my staff is that
after several attempts, if they haven't gotten us that information, we must return their application to them.
Anyway, Madam Chair, may I suggest that we have a, we don't have to have a further briefing on this, but if you could prepare just some analysis of this for us in writing, so we can see what's going on, and then you can suggest to us the steps that are necessary to address this issue. Should there be any necessary, I don't know.
Right.
But can we just have a brief memo?
Absolutely.
Not necessarily a PowerPoint.
Right. Well, I certainly support that, Mr. Graham, and I would like to suggest that we try, to the extent we can, to quantify this. I mean, if we are within a 90-day time frame, should that be a backlog? So I think we need to quantify what is standard and then is what is outside the standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just refer you back to page 5 on your performance measures and ask you if there couldn't be some quantification that we could then follow up on a regular basis to see as we set our goals whether or not we are meeting them, and as Mr. Graham points out here, whether there are additional resources that are needed to meet them, and whether there are any, you know, actions. It would indicate to us whether there are any actions that need to be taken in these important issues that, so that we're not falling behind.
Madam Chair, the other thing is that.
Well, let me see, Mr.
Scott,
I understand, and we did have a briefing scheduled for you, but it was postponed, but we do have a briefing scheduled for you in the near future on this very issue.
Right.
But we will have a memo provided to you as identified, and then we will follow that up with any additional information you may need in the briefing.
Right, and then I think you should work with Chuck, which is part of his whole process of identifying performance measures to see if we can get some quantification.
Oh, absolutely.
I just have one more.
Ms. Graham.
What is our current vacancy? I thank you very much. I appreciate very much your testimony. What is our vacancy rate?
Approximately 6%.
6%?
Yes.
And has that been pretty stable over
it's
time?
Come down some.
Pardon me?
It has come down some, about 1%. It was at around 7%. Now it's running at about 6%.
I see you're committed to bringing it to 4%.
That's correct.
And you think that's realistic?
I think that we're going to work very hard to make it realistic. I hope it is realistic. We believe it's realistic. That's what we're going to, that's our aim.
What is the vacancy rate in terms of what I might describe as entry level, kind of low barrier qualification position? Is it higher there or lower?
I think I'll have to respond back to you in writing on that because I don't have those figures right in front of me.
I would like you to do so because all of us in our jurisdiction have high unemployment rates we're concerned about our unemployment rates, but they're as good in many cases as they've been for people. But we have positions at Methyl LaMotta which are, you know, relatively easy to qualify for. I want to be sure that we are taking steps to fill those. They ought not to be difficult hires. Madam Chair, may I ask that the numbers specifically on the position?
Absolutely. But Mr. Graham, we have a protest over here on your statement of all jurisdictions with high unemployment rate.
No, I said, no, I didn't.
I think, well, oh,
I immediately revised that to say that we're all concerned about the unemployment rate that we have in our jurisdiction.
Okay.
I immediately revised that.
Okay.
Because, you know, even so, but anyway, the point is if we have these positions available, we ought to be. I know there's a considerable turnover in these positions. Can we do that, Madam Chair?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Are there other questions that we have? Gordon.
When you're sitting on my notes, David.
I'm sorry.
Take care of yourself. Sit up, I'm glad to see you.
On page 3 of your presentation, you mentioned close to 5,000 medical exams that are done. What's the nature of those exams?
Pre-employment.
FDA-related. Basically,
they're all drug and alcohol?
Yes.
Okay. So we don't do any type of other medical examinations of our employees?
do?
We have periodicals for the people who are in safety sensitive positions have these exams every 2 years.
Right.
We have, when they come in, they have to pass pre-employment exams. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones we're talking about.
Okay. What about wellness programs? Do we have a wellness program for our employees that we engage in?
We're moving toward a wellness program for non-reps, also with Local 689 Wellness and Disease Management. We're moving in that direction. Hopefully.
I've been looking at those nationwide in terms of cost avoidance.
Yes.
One of the things to look at, particularly within our employment population, are things like diabetes, high blood pressure, or some other kind of things, and whether or not we have wellness programs to deal with some of our healthcare cost issues. Deal on the front end of the basis, right, versus waiting to react and dealing with it on the healthcare cost. I was wondering,
you incorporate that into the RFP for the non-reps, and we are moving in that direction with the Local 689 for both wellness and disease management. We recognize we have an older population as well as unhealthy population. Those things do cut down on healthcare.
Could you provide us, the members of the board, some information on what contracting for that area and regards to Oakland Center?
Okay.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Scott? Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, moving right along. Audit, safety, and oversight. Mr. Stewart and Mr. Levine.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm going to go audit first and then safety after that.
Okay.
In the audit office, we have 27 budgeted positions. I have three managers here in the audience that I'd like for them to stand up so we can introduce them. Bill Raymond, who's responsible for the contract audit function. Barbara Jackson-Williams, who's responsible for control self-assessment. And behind them, Rob Howard, who's responsible for internal audit. Our budget for fiscal year 07 is $2.9 million, which is probably about 99% personnel. It's increased 2% cost of living, and there's no increase in positions. Major cost driver in the non-personnel costs is travel for contract audits. On page 4, workload indicators that we measure in our office are the number of audit reports that we issue, amount of the recommended reductions in adjustments for costs on proposals and claims as a result of our contract audits, number of recommendations that we make on internal and other related audits, and the number of recommendations that are implemented. The number of audit reports issued tracks the output of the office. Recommended adjustments and costs on proposals and claims results in savings to the authority as a result of the contract audit program. Number of recommendations measures the recommended improvements that we have in efficiency and economy in the internal audit program. And the number of recommendations implemented is a measure of the acceptance and the effectiveness of the recommendations made.
Let me stop you for a minute, Jim. Now, here's another case where we really need some quantification of the results so that we can have some comparisons of how we're doing, you know, whether we need improvements, what the resource availability is, and so on.
I have the results a little further in the presentation, but the comparison I don't have.
Right. Okay, go ahead.
Our program involves, we coordinate the external audit activities from the external auditor and GAO and DOT and FTA. We ensure the compliance with the intervention follow-up program that we implemented on audit recommendations. Our internal audit program reviews, evaluates, and monitors the risks and internal controls and processes for the various processes that we have in the authority, cash, debit, credit, revenues, and review the effectiveness of the operating and administrative processes. In the information technology area, we are participating with the ITRP to ensure that the controls are put in place as they're developed, and we also evaluate security issues pertaining to IT. We also monitor the general manager's efficiency hotline and conduct investigations of allegations of fraud, waste, and abuse as they are appropriate. Our control self-assessment program evaluates internal control issues and risk analysis with participating employees. And our contract audit functions, we perform pre-negotiation audits of sole source contracts, modifications of construction, architect, engineering contracts, and equipment-related contracts, and we also participate in oversight of the bus and rail car purchase rehab contracts. The output that we had on page 7, the output that we had during fiscal year 2005, we issued 185 audit reports that are broken down in contract audits, internal audits, investigations. We received 146 calls on the general manager's efficiency hotline from employees and others, which required various actions, either to do investigations or to refer issues to someone else or just provide advice to the caller if it was something that was just needed advice. We coordinated the external audit from KPMG and several audits by GAO and FTA. We issued contract audit reports representing the review of $110 million in costs that were either proposed or claimed, and recommended adjustments of about $10 million on those proposals. We made 195 recommendations for improvements on internal audits and investigative reports, and 100 of those recommendations have been implemented as of December 31st. And the remaining 95 are in the process of being implemented. We're tracking these as a result of our follow-up program. Our goals for fiscal year 2007 pertain to the same items: the issuance of audit reports, recommended adjustments on contract audits, handling of calls to the efficiency hotline, and recommendations for improvement within the internal audit program. Generally speaking, the difference between an inspector general office and an auditor general office is that inspector general is authorized to conduct criminal investigation. We do not conduct criminal investigation. We do administrative investigations. If anything appears to be criminal in nature, we refer it to the police department, who did the criminal investigation. Another thing that inspector generals do that we do but we don't do as much as they do is program evaluations of various programs of an organization.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Lynn.
But isn't it true that inspector generals could, in fact, do what you are currently doing?
Correct.
Some of the things you mentioned were things that are above what you currently do, but
they would do the same.
There are comprehensive inspector general office that include criminal investigation, operational audits.
Yeah, they would do the same things that we do, and he asked what additionally that we don't do.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes.
Right.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Jim. Fred?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I take great pleasure in introducing the management team that I work for, and they are from left to right. Kevin Lyons has been with the authority for 20 years, worked as lead office safety officer to director of passenger vehicle fire life safety and emergency management. Ron Edwards, we drafted it. Ron Edwards, 6 years ago, he played for the NFL, Bengals, and the LA Rams. We played offensive tackle, now he plays safety for WMATA. He heads up our occupational safety and training and also construction safety program. Gene Matthews, we're fortunate to steal her away from the American Red Cross, seasoned veteran in workers' compensation. She managed the national program, so she's here with us 2 years now on workers' compensation, which is badly needed because we're going to go on reform in that particular area. Rich Bidner started his career as a captain in the U.S. Marines and has worked an entire career here in Metro in quality assurance as a quality assurance officer, now director of quality assurance, has turned that program around. So you're looking at about 130 years worth of experience there. As far as our budget goes, we comprise a healthy 1% of the total budget of WMATA, albeit a very important part of WMATA. I wouldn't be telling the truth. I didn't feel a little bit sick to my stomach actually requesting today an increase in the budget to flesh out put some money back into our reserves. We had a 2-year holiday, and now it's back to work. And unfortunately, it's not because of the claims have gone up. it's to really meet our current and past obligations. We inherited a cost center that was well over $10 million to begin with, and then making adjustments with the previous third-party administrator in outstanding claims that were not cases that weren't closed for another $3 million plus. So the good news, though, is that under the reform, we have a new third-party administrator, a new manager of workers' compensation. We have put in the controls in place to contain costs and also to reduce the costs, and I can talk a little bit about that. I will talk about that in a minute as far as what we have done proactively and aggressively to corral those costs and reduce them down the road, okay, actually in the past year or so, and as well as we go forward. That's the cost hitter right there, and not a pleasant one, I admit it. When we look at the Office of Passenger Vehicle Fire Life Safety, this is a very productive unit of our division. We are responsible, as you know, as the custodian of the authority's safety program, and it cuts across all departments, both line and functional departments. And the big thing that's going to hit us this particular year is the revision to the FTA rule, which goes into effect May 1st of 06. It's already requiring probably 75% of one staffer's time, and now we're looking at 100% and perhaps more because of the reporting requirements, not only tracking the National Transit Database requirements, but also tracking accidents, reporting those accidents, and also with the Tri-State Oversight Committee that we're required to, that oversees us, our rail operations. It's become very staff intensive in terms of administrative demands on us. Accident investigations, we average about 8 a month. We conduct the safety design reviews in excess of 30 a month. That's everything with Toxis Group on down. And the reason is we take a system safety approach. That means if it affects the system, if you're thinking about something, whether it's in the design, the planning, the purchasing, the building, the operation, and final disposal of that system, the subsystem, we're in the loop in that and have to review all of those and should. And it's creating a culture of safety. Community outreaches, we touch over 200,000 people face-to-face, face contact with our customers every year for our outreach, like this week at Gallery Place. Also, we service and present emergency management tips to agencies like the FDA and the U.S. Postal Service. Those are things that happen behind the scenes, but it's well over 200,000. Emergency management, we've got national attention with the award over the Carmen Turner facility for the training facility over there. We've trained everyone from Singapore and Taipei to Australia to Puerto Rico to on the domestic side as well. It's been, we received the award thanks to Kevin's efforts, Mr. Lyon's efforts, the After Award for Innovation. This year we won the a site from the FRA to introduce a new a device called a rollover rig so that our first responders throughout the region, by the way, we train in excess of 2,000 a year now, not only firefighters, the startup is fires. We asked the fire chiefs if we build it, will you come? And in fact, they did. They expanded to the law enforcement agencies as well, including CIA, Quantico, military police. So the FTA accepted us as a sole provider of this rollover rig, which enables first responders to actually get experience responding, rescuing passengers should that happen, unlikely event or a capsized or overturned vehicle. Actually, you can picture an exoskeleton, train is inserted and actually rolls the rig over. And that you'll get to see. If you go to, we have a drill tomorrow, multi-agency drill that we're coordinating with our police department internally as well as the fire departments throughout the region. You'll be able to see the makings of that rollover rig, which will be ready this coming spring. We're partnering with our regional fire departments, continuing. Actually, last year we trained over 3,000, and we run over 34 drills a year, and we have four major ones each year. One we're having tomorrow, it's almost like a it's going to be confined to the Carmen Turner facility, and then we'll have one in the spring, which will be under the Potomac River.
Can I ask you a question about the training and the people who come in from around the world
sure.
to use our facility? Do we charge for that service, and does it pay for itself, or what's the financial?
It pays in goodwill. No, we haven't charged them out-of-pocket expenses, nor do we in the region either. We have met with FTA to see if we could actually, if they would sponsor it as a national training facility, because they have a training facility out in Oklahoma City, that they could actually use our base and divert some of the costs from Oklahoma City to Metro to use that facility. So we have thought about that, but right now it's a model program, and we we didn't really think it would take off. We knew it would get the region, but we never thought it would expand across the United States and outside of the United States. But if you go over the facility, you see all the representatives from around the world. But yeah, it's something to consider down the road.
Well, it does draw on additional resources from us, so we ought to look at ways to try to reduce that that demand, mm-hmm. or the cost of the demand.
Now, Prince George's County, we've had a quid pro quo. They have, in exchange of training them, for example, their fire department in Prince George's County, they in turn provide free training, fire extinguisher training to our personnel. All our rail have done that. And the result of that has been dramatic. We used to have in excess of 100 fires that would interrupt service on a daily throughout the year. And I think we have maybe, what, 8 that are pretty much de minimis fires, you know, trash can or ballast light or something. They pretty much defer to us to handle and manage those fire emergencies. Where in the past, they would actually shut us down and delay upwards of rules. Well over one incident we had, well over an hour and 20 minutes. So, tell us.
Madam Chair, I was going to pursue the same line of questioning. I was trying to wait to ask the presentation, but I also was wondering whether or not we need some cost recovery, or in fact, whether or not that could be a training center where we can get resources, either charged or get sponsored by either MTI or FTA, in terms of being a recognized training facility.
Yes, sir.
And we could also use, if there were any, you know, if we made more than it cost, we could use that to benefit our own employees to provide additional training for them.
So, reinvest it.
Yeah, I really think that's something we need to look at.
I'll pursue that aggressively.
Right.
AEDs, it's something that you see around the airports and whatnot around the world you travel, around this country. It's in some of the buildings, office buildings, particularly federal buildings. We started introducing those 2 years ago, and we have 101 now throughout our network, D.C., and all the stations in the Virginia. I don't know if Mr. Deegan talked to anyone in Maryland, but we had talked during the bus rodeo a few months last year, and we just got the licensing removed, so I don't know if you talked to anyone, but we're actually starting to install the Maryland stations this month. We've got 4 locations, so we've got 64 stations left to do. It'll cost about $180,000 to do that, but AEDs are the way to go, and they're user-friendly, and they have been known to enhance the likelihood of fatality due to a sudden heart attack. Used it twice so far. One saved a life, the other one was a complication. But the more and more folks we have, I think it's the right thing to do.
What's an AED?
It's an automatic external defibrillator. Someone should have a sudden heart attack arrest. You'll see them, they're located near the kiosk, or in some cases in the kiosk at some of our stations. Well, actually, all of the Virginia, 9 of the DC locations, and soon to be this month, Maryland. Good, so thank you. Again, we have the MSD project, the Material Safety Data Sheet program. All hazardous materials must be reviewed for obvious reasons, so we can create a helpful work environment for our employees. Review probably 2,000 products a year, and our campaign is No Product Left Behind. And we do review each of those to shoot for product substitution when we can, and put controls on hazardous materials when needed. As far as the metrics go, we measure, we're required to, because we are the liaison with OSHA, FTA, the Tri-State Oversight Committee, NTSB, and all the other regulators and overseers in the state, local, and federal governments. But we also look at upstream data. That's all downstream stuff, and after the fact, accidents that occur. We also look at other things, too, the proactive upstream stuff, like the number of safety committees, the number of hazards identified and resolved, number of outreach programs that we have, certifications, so we address hazards at the front end of the game and not deal with them when they become operational and provide the highest risk of an accident or an incident. And the impact has been, you know, we haven't had a fatality involving an escalator in 8 years. We haven't had a fatality in a bus passenger accident in over 5 years since we put guards on the back tires. Maryland, for example, and MTA Baltimore's had 2 last year and a serious crushing one last year, so 3 basically. So that's paid off. But our focus for next year will actually be on traffic and pedestrian safety around the region. Pedestrian, whether you're talking vehicular or bus, metro, they're going up, and the litigation costs of those celebrated cases are astronomical and growing. So we know we've gone from the passenger safety, and we're moving on to the pedestrian safety aspect and traffic safety. So that's where we're focusing our attention this year and beyond. When it comes to workers' compensation, let me talk about the Office of Industrial Construction and Environmental Safety. We had brought that in-house 5 years ago, shortly after Ron Edwards arrived, because we were paying over $520,000 for external assistance to provide this training. And I said, I can't believe we can't do it cheaper. In fact, we saved close to $200,000 by bringing it in-house, but the value added is that we can provide training 24/7, whereas the contractor was 9-to-5. And we had the recent stand-down after the fatality of the employee on the right-of-way back in October. They're talking 3,300 rail employees going through training. We've gone through half that population already. So it's given us the opportunity. In the coming year, we're actually going to take it to market to enhance productivity in the workplace. You have travel time. Employees go to training. It's travel time to get to the training site and back again, get lost in between, and next thing you know, they've lost a day in production. So what we're doing is we're taking the mobile van, actually bringing the mobile classroom to the respective work locations and providing training on the spot in the respective work locations to make it more relevant as well. The good news is on the industrial side, it's the first time this year that we're actually below the national average for industrial accidents, which account for 44% of our workers' comp claims. The national rate was 11.6 and ours was 11.2. And we train over 2,000 employees, and if anyone's injured on the job, they must see Ron Edwards before they go back to the workplace, before they start work, and they meet with the supervisor too. As far as workers' compensation, that has gone through major reform. We now are focused on case management versus claims processing. In the past, we just processed claims to budget, and really we're not managing the claims as one at a time. Our focus is to reduce the cost of repeated claims. We found that 37% of those claims are repeated. And those persons this year that are out, 37% of them were out before, either the year before or times before that. If you look closely at those records, we have the capability now to see when they occur. Take one person who's out at Christmas week 1 week and Thanksgiving the next week, there's a pattern there. So we're bringing in focus groups to look at these particular repeaters. How can someone like Bob Miles drive forever and never have an industrial accident, and then you have another person with 20-something industrial accidents in 20-year history? It just doesn't make sense. We're also partnering with the union for the first time because we believe that the union leadership has a responsibility, too, to help us shore up safety of our employees. In the past, they would just give out our attorney referral cards. We'd like to be a little more proactive than that and actually help endorse our training programs as well as encourage their employees, their membership, to operate safely within our system and to protect themselves. We have a new settlement review program to train the cost of risk management approach. We take a look at those losses and focus our attention on them. For example, we're paying $500,000 in knee injuries alone on bus operators. Well, yeah, in the past we just processed those claims. A risk management approach to say, what's the probability? Very high, very frequent. What's the severity? $9,000 a case. So what are we doing about it? So we took a low-tech solution by putting Velcro padded material around the fare box area, and already done 6 garages, and we'll finish the rest of them by the end of the spring. We had one case, an operator did injure himself with a padded. It cost $1,189 versus a similar injury a year ago was over $9,000. So it started to pay off there. But that's what we're doing as far as mitigating and reducing the risk of those recurring claims. So over time, we'll beefing up subrogation. We have money out there. A person gets injured and it's not our fault. We go after them now aggressively. And we've already recovered $800,000 in subrogation by having actually someone focusing on that. Return to work, light duty modified work program, which we haven't we implemented last year. We recovered reduced the reserve on that particular $214,000. In FY07, we want to beef that up. So we're talking just with subrogation and a full implementation of a light duty modified work program. We have persons that are able to work, and right now the disincentive is to stay home, watch Oprah or Dr. Phil. When they can come back to work, they may not be able to lift 50 pounds, but they can do something. And we should encourage them, value as employees, whether they're injured or not, to bring them back as soon as possible. The longer they stay out there, the average cost nationally universal is 41% increase per case, the longer they stay out. So we're aggressively holding departments. Also, we're pursuing a chargeback to those offending departments. Chronic problems with lost time injuries, so we bring back, charge back to those departments the cost of those lost time injuries. So we're talking anywhere from $1 to $3 million possibly in recovering down the road in FY07. When it comes to quality assurance, we finally have a quality assurance program here at Metro, and we're working with the operation divisions and Tarkus's engineering group and developing quality control procedures so we can actually ensure that those processes are in place to ensure the quality and reliability of our system. That's already paying dividends in terms of premature wear or breakdowns of our vehicles, and trying to get in the front end of the contract and find out where omissions were made in the contract. If someone says this is required, we do non-conformance reports now. Why doesn't it conform with our contract? You know, may benefit the contract or subcontract by eliminating a step or using an inferior part. But does that mean the train will then break down in 10 years versus 20 years? So we're more progressive and aggressive in that area as well. The bottom line is, at the end of the day, our goal is to ensure the safety of our passengers and our customers and our contractors, ensure the highest quality, and that persons who are injured get back to work as soon as possible, get back to work.
Okay, any questions of Fred?
Fred, thank you. You answered some of the questions that I asked earlier about injury prevention and concerns about wellness. I think there's some other things we can do in that area as well, but I'm glad to see that you have taken a proactive stance in some of the things that you've done here. In terms of workman compensation claims, in my history around the industry, I know that personal history was accepted. I know that was a big ticket item that we at that time spent a lot of money on, and looks like you've had some fairly aggressive efforts to try to address that. Do we have any numbers in terms of benchmarking to know where we stand relative to light systems? Percentage of workman compensation claims, you understand?
Yes, sir. In fact, we looked at SEPTA, we looked at LA, looked at Boston, Chicago. We're about, out of the 10 major transit providers, we're about fifth, halfway. So we certainly have room for improvement.
No further questions.
Mr. Deegan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have a program with Fred, first of all. I applaud everything you're doing here. I think you do a fantastic job.
Thank you, sir.
When you talked on light duty, what are some of the examples of light duty in this authority?
Good question. Thanks for asking. In the past, we would deal with the primary care physician, and we would go over and ask the primary care physician to say, this is a job we would like this your patient to perform, returning back to work. And there's always that provision in requirements, duties and responsibilities that said other duties as assigned. As long as we left that in there, the primary care physician would often say, well, unless I know with specificity what that other duties as assigned is, I can't free my patient up to return to work. So we took the opposite approach, and we went to the primary care physician and said, what can your patient do? And if he said nothing but sitting on his keister, then we say, great, we have a job for him. And then we implemented a program, so we actually have them sitting in bus garages, monitoring buses going in and out. So it serves a security role, as well as seeing their peers driving by every day going, you're out again? And they also have to call for relief. We're also working with Bill Scott to see if other areas. The problem has been the PCN, the position control numbers. I'm working with the union to say, look, we want to bring them back. We've got to make sure that it's not an infringement on an approved position. Working the stations, dealing with passengers, customers. So we started off with 19 positions. We're up to 29. We could accommodate probably 11 to 20 more in a given month. And working aggressively, also bringing them back, vocational rehab too, open positions, plugging them into there, leaving them out there ad infinitum to collect for years on end. So
basically, in some of these departments, we have lots of vacancies, and we can use these people.
We get agreement with the unions, and you know those that are affiliated positions. Sure, that's been the stumbling block. Also, if say bus operations has some money and rail doesn't, you know, to be able to tap into some of that money and free it up and actually underwrite those positions would help as well. Sometimes we look at ourselves divisionally, not as the metro, and bring the person back.
But we'd only send them within the authority, right? We wouldn't
yes.
send them
out. That's correct.
Thanks. That's good.
Anyone else have a question? Fred, I just wanted to thank you and your staff for not allowing a train wreck on my watch. Sure. And I hope you afford the same courtesy to Ms. Mack. Also, I know one of the big challenges you face is with the changes in the workforce with a lot of our very senior, very safe drivers retiring, a lot of new ones coming on board, and also from time to time shifting in the rail. But I having watched track the incidents, this certainly has some initial uncertainty, but appears to be your training changes and some retraining that able to get a handle on some of those bus accidents.
Yes, sir. Our system safety approach, you know, directs you to look at procedures, personnel, equipment, the operating which in the environment in which we operate to produce the desired outcome, i.e. safe driving. We've narrowed it down to human factors. It is human performance. That gets back to training. One, at the front, at the gate, you got to make sure that we have the right controls on the gate, that they latch and lock, that we don't allow persons on board to drive for us. So it starts with the recruitment selection and then with the training. So we have more Bob Miles out there.
Thank you for getting a handle on that. Any other questions? Our next presenter is the Department of Public Affairs and Strategic Programs.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Good morning.
I have with me, joining me at the table, Debbie Lippman, who is the director of our Office of Governmental Relations. Debbie wanted to make sure that I mentioned, in light of this past Sunday's Super Bowl, that at one point in her previous career, she played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. If Ron Edwards could play for the Bengals, she could play for the Steelers. Also with me here at the table is Lisa Farbstein, our acting director of media relations. Just to give you a very quick overview.
Before I yield the chair,
yes,
Ms. Mack, I just wanted to compliment Lisa on her picture. It's very easy. A picture that captures somebody's personality. That's
great. Thank you. Okay. So I'm assuming we just getting started?
We are just getting started.
Okay, go right ahead. Nice picture, Debbie, too.
Yeah.
anyone else?
So we do that one, I guess.
Mr. Woodruff and his budget staff have been urging me to do that. Now I understand why.
What team do you play for?
Moving right along. I play for the Bulls. We have two offices in my department. Debbie's office, which is basically broken down into two branches, which is the policy group, which is relatively new, and the intergovernmental affairs group, which of course, you know, we've had here for quite some time. Lisa's branch, or Lisa's office rather, is divided into two branches, which is essentially the media relations office, which you're all obviously very familiar with, and you're also very familiar with the special events and employee programs branch of that, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we move forward. If we look to the next page, this doesn't have any pictures on it. We move to the next page. That's sort of a summary and overview of our departmental budget. Obviously, as you can see, compared to some of the other departments, ours is relatively small. Any small variances in there tend to stand out a little bit. But you can also see that there are no anticipated increase in budgeted positions between the current fiscal year and next fiscal year.
Ray.
Yes, ma'am.
Mrs. Smith has.
Yes.
Yeah, it happens to be the page I have a question on. Budgeted positions 22, no new positions. Labor costs is increasing $400,000. That's about $18,000 a position.
Well, no, excellent question, and we anticipated that, and I'm going to turn to my budget expert, Rick Harkham, to explain what that difference is.
That's Ray's bonus.
And it's actually going to enable me to get a new photo taken.
It wasn't without concern that it was all in one position.
Well, since he works for us, we get to decide.
Okay, yeah. The real answer is the number for 06 is deceptively low. There were fully lapsed positions in the 06 budget. We talked about vacancies. We assume a certain vacancy rate in the budgets. The positions in 06 were lapsed positions. That's the bullet on the text box there. And they were basically unfunded positions last year.
Do you understand that?
I did, but I didn't like it.
Yeah, why would you carry them over?
But why would they be lapsed to such an extent that you'd have to put money in the budget. A lapse is an average, and so you'd assume that, you know, the
it's
going to ebb and flow in a way that doesn't cause this kind of a bump.
In implementing the reorganization, there was no increase in positions authority-wide. What we did is we took lapsed positions and vacant positions and moved them from other parts of the organization to here. The budget for 07, I believe, is correctly pricing those positions. It's about a $74,000 per year average salary. If you look and see the lapse rates behind the $1.2 million, the lapse rates were just too high.
I know I'm not being clear here.
If I can interject, let me just try to, I'll try to explain it a little bit better than that. In fiscal year 06, we added three positions in the Intergovernmental Affairs and Policy Group. We essentially created the policy group. And so we brought in three new positions in Debbie Litton's shop. The positions that we brought in, because it came after the FY06 budget was finalized, was not reflected in the FY06 budget. So essentially what we're doing now is we're truing up in the, for the FY07 budget, the additional positions, actually four. One is under recruitment, three have been filled, new positions that are that we added in FY06.
So the FY06 number is the budget number, not the actual number.
Correct.
Correct.
But you know, if this is the technique that we use, I don't like it. If we added four positions, why don't we see four positions being added? This says that there's no position change.
Right. They weren't added last year. They're not added this year.
Right.
Well, they're included in the total of 22. I mean, they were added. They were added after the FY06 budget came before you. They were added during the course of this year.
You can have it both ways,
right?
You either got to put it in the money or put it in the position.
Right.
I mean, you can't have the budgeted amount for the money, and then the actual amount for the positions.
Absolutely. And on the lapsed position, Rick, if positions are lapsed because you really don't know which positions are involved, mm-hmm. you can't then activate those positions and then put in money to fill them. Those are new positions.
Yeah, I think the staff should have been clearer in what they did here, but this was something that was beefed up in the reorganization of a year ago. I added these positions in myself in discussion with Debbie and Ray about areas that we needed to beef up inside of the organization coming under the March reorganization. I think staff just didn't do a very good job here of painting the picture of the pre and the post based upon, you know, the technicalities of how the budget was put together. But the simple fact of the matter is that there were four positions added in.
Right. And
inside of the existing headcount of the authority.
I think in the future, if within a year we add positions, that has to be a temporary action, and those positions then have to be approved as new positions the first opportunity you get in the budget.
Okay. And we need, the money needs to follow the positions, as Mr. Smith points out. We can't have one and not the other. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right. And can I just ask, on all the other charts we've seen then, so the FY 2006 number is the budgeted number, not the actual number
right.
throughout then?
Right. Always budget to budget comparisons.
Okay.
Yeah, that, there's just a lot to be unknown in using that approach. Okay, Mr.
Just so we don't have actual.
Well,
we're looking at, wait a minute.
We're only halfway.
We're looking at FY07 budget and comparing it with FY06
budget.
And without any actuals.
We're only halfway through 06, so I can't.
But still.
We could compare it to 05 actuals, but again, because of the reorganization, this cost center technically didn't exist in 05, so I don't have an actual to put up against it. If there's a reorganization and a new entity is created, I don't have a basis of actuals to compare it to.
But let me ask you, do our rules allow a new entity to be created without coming back to the board?
Yes, ma'am.
It does? Yes, ma'am. I thought our reprogramming required that any increases come back to the board.
Increases in budgeted positions do, and what we're saying is there was no increase in budgeted positions authority-wide. That's at the bottom line. There was 10,000 X positions. After this, there's still 10,000 X positions.
But another $400,000 in costs, so that's
yes
outside of any authority that...
Well, this is a proposed budget increase. This isn't something that has happened for execution purposes. This is the budget that you...
But another part of the organization went down by the same amount.
Right.
I mean, it's not a gain. It's a plus and a minus.
Yeah, the position count is a net zero.
Oh, I understand the position.
Okay.
I mean, the problem is we seem to be treating positions one way and the money another way. That's the concern that I have. And so I think in the future, Chuck, we ought to all know what the rules are. And I think this is a case of our not knowing the rules.
I agree, and I think however we reorganize, the money needs to follow the positions, and we need to update the current year budget so we don't get in this conversation.
Absolutely.
So I hear exactly what you're saying.
Sure.
I mean, in terms of what you're saying about the net position numbers didn't change, mm-hmm. I mean, that's true. But, you know, in holding the hand of cards there, you know how many, you know that you have positions that aren't being filled, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could predict with reasonable certainty that the net position number wouldn't have to change in creating a significant number of positions.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
But we're going to fix this. This is really
I would like to see, an FY06 year-to-date actual on personnel.
Okay.
And have that, even the global number, I think, would be of interest to you.
If I don't want to take us back to the start of the day, but the monthly report does that for us in the financial tables. Halfway through the fiscal year, our labor cost is
3.4.
I'm sorry, I'm on page B1 of the December financial report.
Financial results.
Right in the middle of page B1, where it's just below the bolded phrase where it says operating expense, you can see the labor line, what we're talking about here, this payroll expense. And way out on the right-hand side, there's a negative 3715.
Right.
That means we are $3.7 million over budget on the payroll expense for the year, which is about a 1% variance. So on a year-to-date basis, we have a budget of $290 million, actual expense of $293 million. That line item in the budget is $3 million over budget.
And where's the FY05 budget?
05 budget's not displayed in this report. I've got it sitting in the book here. You can see 05 actuals.
I don't see FY05.
No, this would display 05 actual as a base of comparison and the 06 budget and actuals. We're in 06 right this minute. So halfway through last year, we had spent $275 million. Halfway through this year, we've spent $293 million. The budget assumed this year we would have only spent $290 million.
At this point?
Yes, absolutely.
I guess the only other question I have on this is, do we have other instances where we've added positions or reduced positions that we can't see because we're looking at net numbers here?
Can I get back to you on that? I think there is. I think okay. There is. And rather than guess right now, I'd rather go look at the numbers and get back to you.
That's fine. Okay. Okay, great. All right. We'll take a second. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ray.
Okay. We'll move along to the next page. In the interest of time, I'll be brief. This kind of reflects what is done in the media relations and special event planning branch. You can see in front of you the number of media calls that we handle every year and the number of news releases that we issue every year. Averages over one per day, obviously. One thing you may not be aware of, this office is also responsible for coordinating requests that we get from television shows and movies that want to shoot scenes in our system. We get that very frequently. As Mrs. Mack knows, she and I have worked together on a number of movies, Along Came a Spider and some others, where they want to do things in our system, and we need to work with them to make sure that what they want to do is consistent with our use regulations. So we're very much involved in that. We We try to be friendly and open to movies and television shows being filmed here, but at the same time make sure that it's consistent with the use regulations that you all have approved. We're involved in special events and those sorts of things. On the next page, a little more activities that are related to our budget in terms of what type of activities are done in the media relations and event planning office. And then on the next page, give you a summary of the work that's supported by our budget in Debbie Lippman's Office of Intergovernmental Relations office. You see the federal funding that we've secured for rail cars, for bus purchases, for security in the aftermath of 9/11/01, the outreach work that we do at the federal, state, and local levels, the jurisdictional coordination that's involved with Homeland Security and the UASI grants, joint development, and with COG, and then as we talked about a few moments ago, the new policy analysis section that was created in the reorganization by the CEO to work on a number of different issues, including some of the presentations that we see here in this room, innovative financing, the implementation of the new reauthorization, the safety lieu, and human service transportation funding.
Madam Chair.
I don't know.
Could I get a more in-depth, and could you provide to the board a more in-depth explanation of the new policy analysis committee and the roles and functions and the nature of the staff that you're hiring, so I get a little better feel of what that entails?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the questions, the final page just kind of gives you a summary of what our primary goals are that are tied to the budget for FY07. And obviously, we're going to continue to seek appropriations for new rail cars that are authorized, not yet appropriated in safety lieu, finalize amendment to the Largo Full Funding Grant Agreement for the 104 rail cars, continue to work with the jurisdictions, Maryland, Virginia, and the district for additional funding and UASI funding. Continue to work to maximize Homeland Security funding, policy analysis, and continued outreach with state and local officials and stakeholders.
Mr. Deegan has a question.
Yes, sir.
Ray, back on page 5, you mentioned the 48 issues of the employee newsletter, and that's at
Metro Weekly.
Yeah, the Kathy does.
Yes, sir.
Does a great job. What are the 12 issues of the board newsletter?
The board digest, we work with the CEO and general manager in the board digest that is presented to you at every board meeting. We work with CEO in preparing that report.
So we call that the board newsletter?
It's technically called board digest, but it's the general manager CEO's report to the board.
General manager's report.
Yeah. We just assist in the production of it.
I didn't, just wonder if we had a newsletter, I didn't know about
it. You're not reading your materials.
Mr. Kaufman.
Two things. I'd just like to begin with complimenting Ms. Lippman and her staff on our efforts to get to be dedicated financing. As a matter of fact, I'll be leaving here to go before a State Senate Finance Committee meeting later this afternoon. And you know, for the first time in literally a generation, the Virginia General Assembly is getting serious about it. I credit Mr. Cost efforts and your efforts on that as well. The other thing I had kind of doing, taking a page out of Chuck's playbook, is looking at how Fairfax County has handled public affairs and overlaying that on some of the functions we have in our public affairs office. One of the things I specifically noted is the difference. Fairfax County has within public affairs, a senior deputy who basically an emergency communications person, an individual who works with all the other aspects of the county to help prepare for how to handle emergency communications, and then becomes a key player when those incidents happen. And I'm just wondering, how do we prepare our folks for emergency communications, and how are we currently filling that role?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, and Lisa may want to elaborate. I mean, Lisa Farbstein with Candace Smith sort of as her backup kind of perform that function now. One of the things that we definitely want to do in this current year, we've done it already once or twice before, but we want to enhance that and do it more in FY07, is media training for just that sort of thing. We developed a curriculum in-house. We do it in-house. And we provide media training for those folks who would be involved in everything, including emergencies. If there were emergencies in the system, if those folks had to communicate what is going on in the Metro Rail system, we want to provide media training. We have a lot of new folks that have come on since the last time we did our internal media training, and so we want to strengthen that and enhance that. But as I say, you know, Lisa and Candace sort of do that now in terms of, you know, our existing staff, and they do a pretty effective job of working with all the different departments and offices on giving them support and advice in terms of communicating during emergencies. We work very closely with Fred and his folks and Chief Hansen and her folks. I'm not sure if that addresses your question.
Pretty much. Again, I just find it interesting that it's a separate identified function and not here in this task, is as you look at that on a go-forward basis, just, you know, consider maybe chat with our folks over there and see if there's any additional refinements that you might think we'll do.
Absolutely, we'll do that.
Any questions for us? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it very much. All right. Now, let's do a time check. We hope that we can adjourn at 12, the review of the service levels of bus, rail, and paratransit can be as short or as involved as we'd like to have it. Do we want to do that now, or do we want to do that at a subsequent meeting?
Well, Madam Chair, I note that the action items, at least A and B, are reimbursable projects.
Right.
Is C as well?
Yep.
If they're all reimbursable projects, unless the region or the jurisdictions that have those projects want to highlight them in some way, I'd be willing to move those. And
second. A second. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, those are approved.
And then there's an item on a
professional technical labor legal consultant.
Okay, I'll move item 4A as well, which is the professional technical labor legal services consulting contract.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. That's approved.
Okay, with that,
okay.
That should give you
so
some time.
So now we have 15 minutes.
Come on, I'm always at the end with not enough time.
We don't make the agenda.
I'm here today to present the information that's in our budget. We presented it in December about our bus and our rail service improvements. I will get through these in 15 minutes. I would like to start, though, by acknowledging a couple people. Most of them have done the work on it. Sitting over here is Bob Orr. You met him as we did the budget. He does our planning and scheduling, and all the bus service planning comes under him. Jim Strader and Tanji Mobley are from our bus transportation department. Tanji's in charge of all the bus transportation, and Jim's in charge of the street operation. A lot of the recommendations, particularly from the corridors, are in here. They came out of their joint work together.
I just want to say, I noticed that this presentation is more than 20 pages, the PowerPoint. And you probably would take the 15 minutes, but there are questions about this information, how we can have all of that occur in 15 minutes, unless he abbreviates the PowerPoint presentation.
Well, let's wade into it. If it takes a few extra minutes, that should be okay.
Because you've instructed others.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I'm going through every single page.
I have another unreadiness in light of the fact that this is the year of the bus.
Yeah.
I spent so much time, you, Madam Chair, discussing our needs to address these bus-related issues. This is an opportunity where it's to be addressed in the budget, and we are rendering its importance to 15 minutes squeezed between the time period of our dismissal at 12. I think that reflects the interest.
Sure, if it's the committee's desire, that's fine.
No, absolutely. This is important. This is important. And I have a number of questions.
I'm fine either way.
But I just don't see us having the time.
That's why I put it on the table initially. We wanted to go ahead, and so now we don't want to go ahead, so it's fine. We'll put it on a subsequent agenda.
So,
we'll make it first.
Thank you. I just don't know how we can do it. I mean, either do that or recognize that we're going to be here for an hour.
An hour.
You know, it's one or the other, right?
Is it primarily a bus-driven question?
It's also Metro Act, it's kind of traffic.
I'm just wondering if there is a segment of the modifications on this.
We've decided we're going to put it on the next agenda.
I think we should.
Okay, fine.
Very important.
And with that, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.
Good job, Jim.